I just did. We're back.
Let me ask you guys, do you think what we look like, how strong we are or how weak, how much can we tweak that? How much can we tweak how smart or not so smart we are, and how much can we tweak our financial status? Well, I mean, in America, we would probably have ourselves believe that, you know, rags to riches, and that's what's great about this country, and there's some truth to that, especially in the Jewish community. I do a lot of fundraising. It's unbelievable how many Jews are extraordinarily wealthy who came here penniless after the Second World War and literally went from nothing to, you know, huge real estate moguls and, like, major people at Goldman Sachs and financial houses and, like... So it's true. But statistically, do we how much control do we have over those things? And what really is free will? Is that really involved with free will? Free will means how strong I can be. Free will means how rich I can be. Free will means how smart I can be. No, that's not what free will is. And the reason these things do not impinge on free will, and the reason that the angel only asks about those things and not whether this person will be a Rasha, a righteous person, or a wicked person, is because that's where your free will comes in. Don't fool yourself into thinking that you have free will over everything. You don't. Because you know what? When I was the same age, 18, I went to the gym because I felt very thin and scrawny and I wanted to bulk up. And I did. I had 6 meals a day. I ate crazy amounts of carbs and eggs. And I lifted as heavy weight as I could. Less reps, more bulk and weight. And I pushed myself and I came back like 15, 20 pounds heavier muscle. I was a machine when I was 18, 19. It was like unbelievable. But I still was nowhere near some of my friends who were just born that way, who just, when they hit puberty, they just developed that way and they did very little in terms of the gym. And I had the same experience intellectually in college and in graduate school. I worked really, really hard. But you know, I was in a class, I was in a Talmud class at Yeshiva University. I was in the same class for 5 years. And it was this unwritten rule when you were in the class, like there were about 70, 80 students. And it was one of the top Talmudic classes. First year or two, I just had a really hard time just following class. But I wanted to be, I loved what the rabbi was doing, and I wanted to get it. And then, you know, as you got better in the class, you physically moved up. No one said it, but it just happened. And I would watch these guys younger. I was like 19, 20, 21, 22, right? And then like some 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid, and I was 21, would come. And then like within a year, he was sitting next to me. I'm like, what are you sitting next to me? Took me 3 years to get over here. And then some kid would like, and then he'd be in front. And I was killing myself. And, you know, it got me down. And you could say the same thing about money. Because a lot of this is predetermined. Yes, rags to riches, but most people who have a lot of money either come from money or were given opportunities to make a lot of money by being sent to good schools or having good values in their family, valuing education. My Zaidi didn't have any money, my father's father, but he valued education and went crazy to make sure that my dad and my uncle got an excellent education, and they had nothing. They worked through school, they took extra jobs. So let's say you're not born into a family that either has the money or values that. Your opportunity is not going to be the same. You mean to tell me? You don't choose your family. You don't choose your neighborhood, your socioeconomic status. You don't choose your weight class. And you don't choose the deck of cards that you've dealt with in life. But you get to choose one thing. And that is what to do with the deck of cards. How to shuffle it around. How to manipulate it, how to make it yours. How to take the challenges and the gifts, the talents and the setbacks, and somehow work it. Somehow work it to develop yourself. And that's what a tzaddik and a rasha is about, and that's the only thing that matters as far as Judaism is concerned, and that's what Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are all about. We don't get evaluated or tested on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur how much money we made this year. Or how strong we are, or how smart we are. I remember this years ago, I heard Rebbetzin Youngreis, who was a great teacher of our generation. She's passed away just a few years ago. And she said, I was in her class, and she said this, and I remember she was very emphatic. She said, boys, and she's a clever one, boys and girls. She was an old Holocaust survivor, Hungarian woman about this high, and she was just very powerful. She said, it doesn't matter if you're a doctor or a lawyer or you're a cab driver. What matters in Judaism is what kind of doctor, what kind of lawyer, and what kind of cab driver are you. That's what matters. Do you give your passenger back the proper change? Do you treat your client with dignity? Do you have a little of compassion and empathy if you're a physician and you're trying to help your patient through a difficult time? Whether you're a good doctor is super important. Whether you're a good attorney and you can represent your client properly in court, and you don't want to get into an accident if you're driving a cab. Those are all really important things. But that's not what we get evaluated on in life as far as Torah is concerned, and certainly not on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And that's why we can still ascertain and establish that we have free will, because free will is not whether I'm going to have a burger, you know, like the chicken burger or the beef burger or the turkey burger. That's not called a free will decision. That's a decision that your salivary glands are making for you. Okay, that's your stomach talking, not your mind or your soul. Your mind and your soul operate when there's an ethical decision, when you have to choose how to deal with certain things. And that's a very, very important idea. And by the way, we should never imagine that we're in any situation where we are not in control of how we deal with the situation. I didn't say the circumstances, because we're not in control of the circumstances. God forbid somebody gets sick. You can't control that. The only thing left to control, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this, I told you I was going to keep quoting him this year. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik said, you cannot control what happens to you in life. You have control over one thing, how to deal with it. Nobody can take that away, and how you deal with it is ultimately what makes us a righteous or not righteous person. Okay, I want to get into anger in a minute, but let's hear some questions or comments, and then we'll talk about anger. Please.
So I understand that obviously we can't control the situation, but also in terms of how to react towards it. If you have a good role model, if you have someone
of course
who pushes you forward, that changes it, and you can't control if you have a good role model.
Yes, you can. It's an excellent point. You can't control whether good role models just happen to be in your orbit. Like, I was blessed with that. My parents sent me to schools where the role models were right there. I just had to seek them out. But you want to know something? I had plenty of friends who went to the same schools. They didn't seek out the role models. They were sitting right next to them, but they didn't run after them. And I have other friends that didn't grow up in such kinds of families, and they ran looking for them. You don't need to be handed a role model on a silver platter to make that person your mentor. And you're 100% correct that without that, it's going to be very, very difficult. 100%. That's a really excellent point. Role models are everything. But that's a choice. That's a choice who you decide to surround yourself with. It's a great point. Any other questions or comments just about any of the free will thing? Okay. Yes, question.
Is there a rational argument to say, to differentiate between the decisions in terms of saying that one's free will and one's not? Like, I definitely get...
I guess anything purely circumstantial, or physical.
Like, can I say, yeah. Let's say, for example, that my reaction to the situation is just because of the way that my brain's made up.
Right. So that's exactly what I was referring to. It was a New York Times article in the Science Edition years ago. It was called Free Will, Now You Have It, Now You Don't. And there were interesting studies about how much of our behavior is predetermined. Now, Benedict Spinoza, who's considered more of intellectually an outcast in the Jewish community, was a great philosopher, and he didn't believe in free will. Neither did Einstein, by the way. Albert Einstein considered himself philosophically, he believed in God, a God of creation. And he made that very, very clear. I've read a number of biographies about Einstein, but he didn't believe in free will. And there are some, and I think that's very much, it stands very much in opposition of classical Judaism. That, you know, and by the way, we saw this. I read op-eds in the height of the Second Intifada. What can you expect from the Palestinian people who are deprived of liberty and freedom of movement by an occupying force? What can you expect of such an individual other than to strap themselves with a bomb and blow up innocent civilians? How else can they be heard? How else can they live in freedom? And this is an argument that is being made in our world today, in our Western society, that we don't have control. I'll tell you something that's very important. Viktor Frankl wrote one of the most important books everyone here should read. We've talked about this, Josh, Man's Search of Meaning. And he said that the Nazis were trying to prove, by subjecting Jews in the camps to the most extreme of physical circumstances, that even a human being can be controlled just like an animal. If you put a human being and you treat him like an animal, he will behave like an animal. And Viktor Frankl said, and he was a Freudian psychoanalyst before the war. He developed this thing called logotherapy. He went off on his own. He wrote that every time a Jew parted with their rations, as seldom as that might have been in the camps, but every time somebody did something out of character, if you will, that wasn't simply about survival, they proved the Nazis wrong. That human beings will always have free will, even under the most extreme circumstances. And that's what the Nazis are trying to do. They were trying to strip us of our free will. And I think that's a very, very important, that's a really relevant issue today. Whether or not, you know, we look the other way when some people do certain things, we don't hold them accountable. I mean, I'm a big Law and Order. I Westlawed this, if any lawyers in here, to check. And this actually happened. It was a hockey coach. You know about the hockey coach Law and Order one? It was a crazy story. Some kid is on a hockey team, and the college scouts come to the game, and they're looking, you know, who's going to get a scholarship to some of these colleges of real serious hockey teams. And for some reason, the coach pulled the kid out, and the father went ballistic because he didn't think his kid was going to, you know, and you see what people do to get their kids into colleges, okay? The father lunged, this is many years ago, it was like in the 90s, the father lunged at the college coach and started choking him. It didn't intend to kill him, but he inadvertently killed him. And he was brought up on charges of manslaughter, and the defense argued that he could not be held accountable for his actions because given, and this is a good segue to the next part of my discussion with you, given the propensity to anger that this man had and this, in the set of circumstances, how could you expect someone who gets angry, you know, and the circumstances, there was so much riding on this kid playing at that time, and the coach had the chutzpah to take him out. So we have to understand, now, the defense didn't buy it, and he was convicted of manslaughter. He went to jail. But the fact that could even be argued, that he was stripped of free will. Now, this is a good segue to the next part of our discussion, which I want to spend just the next 15 minutes talking to you about, and that is anger. The Rambam says, and there's exceptions to every rule, what's the rule? Middle of the road. Remember we talked about middle of the road? You'll put that in your homework. He says there's an exception. What's the exception? Anger. The Rambam says when it comes to anger, someone should go to the opposite extreme. Let's see if I can take a look. Look, turn the page where it says dealing with anger. Anger is an exceptionally bad quality. Just page 2 on your handout. Where it says Hilchot Deot, chapter 2, halakha 3. You guys with me? Excellent. Anger is also an exceptionally bad quality. It's fitting and proper for one to move away from it and adopt the opposite extreme. Now, we always said that the goal is to get in the middle, but not so with anger. He should school himself not to become angry, even when it's fitting to be angry. Now, what did we say before? That's not good. How are you going to educate people then? If you should wish to arouse fear in his children or household, why do you want to arouse fear? I mean, we have some teachers here. What do you do if some kids, you know, just, I don't know, does something really inappropriate in class, and you're like, oh, that's okay. We love everybody. And, you know, the Rambam says anger is bad, so I'm just going to smile as you, you know, spit in my face or do something really awful. All right? You're not supposed to do it. But then the Rambam says, what do you do to arouse fear within children or household within the community? If he's a communal leader and wishes to be angry at them, to motivate them, to return them to the proper path, he should present an angry front to punish them, but he should inwardly be calm. He should be like one, I'm sorry, this is cut off, if anybody could guess that word, who acts out of the part of an angry man in his wrath, but not himself angry. And the early sages said anyone who becomes angry is like one who worships idols. They also said one who becomes angry is if he is a wise man, his wisdom leaves him. If he is a prophet, his prophecy leaves him. The life of the irate is not a true life. Therefore, they have directed that one distance oneself from anger and accustom himself not to feel anything, even to things which evoke anger. This is the good path. Think about that. The Rambam says, go to the other extreme. You'll need to display anger, but you should never feel it. Now, I don't know. I'm not on that level. I'm just reading you what the Rambam says. This is what he says is the goal. Question is why? Why would he advocate going to such an opposite extreme? And he writes about this elsewhere. First of all, anger causes tremendous conflict. It is the main trait which can and has actually led to actual murder. I just gave you a story about that. I saw another article in the paper about a guy who killed his neighbor over a dispute involving a garbage pan. A farmer who killed his neighbor for planting the same crop he planted, and a grocery store owner who killed his neighbor, who was a restaurant owner, for selling the same type of bread rolls. Anger. I can't believe it's about the garbage or the bread rolls. And even if we don't go this extreme, we could probably all remember doing something really stupid when we were in anger. And I think I mentioned this last week. What happens when we get angry physically? Blood flows to where it's needed the most to defend ourselves from injury. The body produces more adrenaline to give us strength to fight or flight. And then when we get angry, there's less blood that's flowing to our brains, receives less oxygen, we're not thinking clearly. And we usually come and say really stupid things. And that's why there are a couple of ideas I would like to share with you. Look at source number 6, by the way. It's a really interesting source on the bottom. It's source number 6. It's a passage from the Talmud. He says there are 3 things that a person's true character can be perceived. Do you have? Oh, there you go, my friend. No, not at all. There are 3 things. Shlosha dvarim adam nikar. You can tell how a person really is in 3 areas. And it's kind of like a play on words. Bikoso, bikiso, ubikaso. Anybody know what's bikoso? Koso is a cup, but it's referring to a cup filled with, not like orange juice, but wine or alcohol. Right? Kiso is your wallet, money. And koso is your anger. Think about those 3 things. How people deal with money, when they get angry, and when they get drunk. Everybody's a little different. The Talmud says that when you put a little wine and a little alcohol, out comes the secrets. Depends what's going on in there. And Rabbeinu Yonah writes, one of the great Talmudic commentators, that in these 3 cases, the power of the intellect becomes largely inoperative, and our inherent instincts begin to surface. And maybe, I never understood this, how could the rabbis in the Talmud say that if you get angry, it's like you're worshipping idols? Really? I mean, worshipping idols? Everybody gets a little angry, come on. But I think what it's teaching is that a foreign force takes over. Something else is operating. This is not you. This is not the way you are. This is something else happening. Rashi, the great biblical commentator, tells us that, you remember, this is my favorite plague. I don't know everybody on your Passover Seder. I hope you have a favorite plague. My favorite plague is frogs. Who cannot like the frogs? They're so much fun. How did the frogs start? There were frogs here, frogs there, frogs everywhere. My kids used to sing that. And the rabbis tell us that it all started with one really big frog. And one Egyptian saw this huge frog and tried to kill it. And every time the Egyptian hit the frog, it multiplied. It hit one, it turned into 2, it hit both, it turned into 4, the 4 turned into 8, it just kept going and kept going until it just, there were frogs everywhere. And then the rabbis ask, I don't understand. The great rabbinic sage, the Stiper, says if the Egyptians were very smart people, they built the pyramids. If they saw every time they hit the fakat, the frog, it multiplied, why don't they stop hitting the frogs? And he said, because there's nothing to do with intellect. They couldn't control themselves. They were operating out of anger and frustration. Maimonides says also that ultimately it was anger that caused Moshe to hit the rock instead of speaking to it when the Jews were thirsty in the wilderness, which ultimately prevented him from entering the land of Israel. So, it's huge.
What about self-defense?
Well, that's why God gave us anger. And that's why God gave us flight and fright, and you're supposed to, you need it. You know, if you cannot oppose a force properly if you don't hate a little. Nobody likes to talk about this, but you know, sometimes Judaism and Christianity get confused. We don't believe in turning the other cheek. If there's an enemy who represents corrupt values and who's out to get you, you have a responsibility to take out the enemy. We don't glorify war. You never see, you go to Israel, you know how many wars Israel has won? Every single battle it's ever fought, or else it wouldn't be here. Israel's won every war it's been in. You ever see any like statues of Israeli generals like on horses holding like a... You go to every monument everywhere in the world, there's always like a... Right? Think about it. There are no arches in Israel with figurines of great soldiers battling. It's the Tzva Hagana Yisrael. It's Israeli defense forces. But we do believe in defending. And you can't really defend if you love something. You have to learn actually to hate certain things. But that doesn't mean we glorify it. So sometimes anger is appropriate. When else is anger appropriate? Displaying anger, if you're a teacher. Now, you don't want to get too out of hand, but if you don't display some level of disappointment in your student, then the student will not learn what's right or wrong. Or as a parent, if you're just chill and you're cool with everything, kid's not going to know the difference between right and wrong. But Maimonides says the highest level is actually not to feel it in here. I mean, I don't know who really does this, but the ideal is that you don't actually feel it internally, but you manifest it externally, so you're a good educator. Good luck. I'm just giving you the ideal. This is what he says. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of solutions so you're not here all night. Breathe slowly. The extra oxygen, I talked about this last week, calms our muscles. And by the way, it's not just saying something. Today, it's the email. Today, it's the WhatsApp. It's the Facebook post. Think, think, think. Or, if you're just so angry, don't think. Put it down. Literally put the phone down and walk away. Give yourself an hour to cool off. Show it to a friend before you send it. I've never regretted doing that, and I've always regretted when I didn't have another pair of eyes that looked at it, or if I was too embarrassed and I didn't want to share, leave it for 24 hours. It's going to be the same issue the next day. And what we do, and you know what happens when the emails start doing this, that, and that, they're literally bouncing off each other and it escalates. The Meiri, one of the great early commentators on the Talmud, related that there was a wonderful ruler of Arabia, a great Arab ruler, who testified that one of the earlier kings, an honest and God-fearing man, but someone who struggled with anger, gave his servant a note with three sentences. I have the sentences for you. And said, every time I get angry, bring me this note. Look what the sentences are. Number one, remember it's page 3 on top. I wrote possible remedies to anger. Number one, remember that you were created and not the creator. And we talked about anger and I asked you guys good suggestions. I think Josh or someone here said praying. You remember that you're not the creator. You're not the end all and be all. There's someone beyond you and above you. That's the reason, by the way, we wear kippot. We wear a yarmulke, particularly men who need, in my opinion, more reminders of something beyond us. You are flesh and blood, and in the future you will rot and decay. That's a nice thought in the middle of the day. Because you're thinking about, like, I'm old. By the way, think about that for a minute. Why do we get angry? You only get angry usually. Someone else mentioned gratitude, practicing gratitude. Who said that here? Right. You get angry because you have a certain expectation. And when the expectation isn't met, then you get upset because you thought it was going to be that way. Why do you have such an expectation? I'm not saying you. I get angry all the time. Why was that expectation there? I don't know. Did somebody tell me when I was born, by the way, you're going to be entitled to the following 82 things, and we don't get that thing, number 56, you're entitled to be angry. Why? Who said I was deserving of that thing, necessarily? It's another explanation, worshiping idols. The world has to revolve around what I think is right and wrong. When it doesn't, I'm going to get upset, because that's the way I think it should be. And number three, remember that you will not be loved tomorrow if you do not love today. I love that line. It's kind of progressive for a medieval king to write that down. And these are the three lines. that. Now, I want to give you a couple of other sources from the Torah. Take a look. Another way of not getting angry with other people is look at the whole person. What does it say in the ethics of our fathers? Read with me, Pirkei Avot, right? Joshua and Prachi Netayra Bailey received this tradition. Yoshua and Prachi Omer, Aseh Lecha Rav, make for yourself a rabbi. Uknei Lecha Chaver, acquire for yourself a friend. Vahaveidanet Kol Adam Lekav Zuchut. Give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Now you can read, give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Why does it have to say, Haveidan et kol ha'adam l'kav zchut? It could have just said, Haveidan l'kav zchut. Or Haveidan adam l'kav zchut. Which means give people, why does it say give all the people? So you could say, oh, I mean all the people. Don't just give that guy the benefit of the doubt, or your relative, or your friend, but give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Another interpretation is, Haveidan et kol ha'adam. Here's a little hint how to give people the benefit of the doubt, not to get as angry. What does it say? Et kol. Kol means all. Look at the whole person. We usually get angry because we hone in on one thing that the person just said or did that was offensive. If we could actually look at the total person and say, you know what, this, what that person just said and did would really upset me, but look at the whole person. Look how many times this person was there for me. Look how many times this person did not disappoint me. And that could also help deal and put that bad thing, that wrong, in its proper perspective. The other thing, the number four, I wrote over here. I wrote recite blessings. And later in the year, we're going to have some classes about brachot. You know what blessings do? When you say a blessing before you eat, and when you recite a blessing, and you acknowledge the fruit, the candy, the water, you become a more of a grateful person. You start appreciating things that we previously perhaps took for granted. And when you start living that kind of life, I'm not saying nothing ticks you off anymore. There are plenty of people who make brachos who still get angry. But you'll get less angry, or you'll get angry less often, if you're really thinking about the blessings you're making. Because you realize how many brachot you have in your life, how many wonderful things you have. And then when that bad thing happens and makes you upset, again, you can put it in its proper context. The next thing, I'll maybe end with this. And then one last point. Get it off your chest. Don't let it fester. We said this is a verse in the Torah. Take a look on the source, on the middle of the page. Lo tisna tachicha belvavecha. It says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. Okay, that's a tall order. But you're not allowed to hate your fellow Jew. A lot of people say, does that only apply to fellow Jew? Start with your fellow Jew. Okay? It's really ideally for everyone, but the Torah only obligates you for your fellow Jew. You're not supposed to actually hate. Now, you asked before, what if somebody is evil and corrupt? So the answer is you're supposed to try to hate, not the person, but the activity. That's how you can have arguments and debates between people who vehemently disagreed. You know who the greatest adversaries in the Talmud always are arguing? Hillel and Shammai. Now you know about Hillel and Shammai? They argued over everything. They disagreed over most. But Hillel and Shammai had children who married into each other's families. How did they do that? How could they argue all the time? Somebody asked me during the election, you think it's okay somebody who was a little more right-wing was being set up with someone who was a little more liberal? And I said, you know, can a Republican date a Democrat? I said, that is a ridiculous question. Of course they can. I don't know anymore. Everybody's so polarized today. It's a ridiculous thing that people who disagree can't fall in love with each other or can't still respect each other. And that's what's happened in our civil discourse today. That's a whole other conversation. Why am I talking about this? Oh, so the Talmud says that the reason every time they quote Hillel and Shammai, they never quote them by their names, Hillel and Shammai. They say Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. The house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. The house is like the academy of and the academy of. Because it was an intellectual argument. And they never got personal. They disagreed with each other's opinions, but they still respected their adversary. That's how truth is arrived at, by budding argument. We want debate. We want healthy debate. That's how you arrive at the truth. But we don't personalize it. So, on one hand, we're not supposed to really hate anyone. But you can hate activities. Ochech tochech et amitecha, rebuke your neighbor, it says. Veloti salav chet, and do not bear sin. And all the rabbis ask, what does that mean, rebuke your neighbor, and don't bear sin? And why are these three clauses in the same verse? Don't hate, rebuke, and don't bear sin. What sin? The sin of hating your neighbor, which will happen if you don't rebuke. We are non-confrontational by nature, and we don't want to take on our friends. So we let it go, and we don't say anything. And it's a big mistake. And I'm not saying you should say something every time. You can't always express your discontent and your disappointment, because then it's like, oh, you're always upset. It's never good enough. You have to pick your battles. But when something is bothering you, wait a little and call your friend and say, this really upset me. Discuss it with them. Don't brush it under the rug. Here's a little of a hint how to do it, and I learned this in couples therapy. All the rabbis, we went for couples therapy licensing a bunch of years ago. Always put it on yourself. By definition, you will make somebody else defensive if you attack them and you say, you know, when you did this, why did you? Just that terminology, why did you? If you say something to the effect of, you know, when you did this, it made me feel. I know it sounds so stupid. When you did this, it made me feel. This is what I was experiencing when that happened. I. The worst thing they could say is, you're a wuss and you're overly sensitive. Right? You know, stop being so sensitive. But, you know, nobody says that. I try to teach my kids, you can't argue with people's feelings. Feelings are your feelings. That's what you're experiencing. You tell people, this is what I'm feeling right now. When you said that, it made me feel this. When you did that, it made me experience this emotion. Throw it out there. Alone, by the way. Not in front of other people. And wait for the right time. Don't wait till your friend is stressed out in front of other people. And why did you do that? Right? You have to be a little smart about it, but don't let it go. Question.
So I think you bring up an interesting topic, which is relationships. When I just sit by myself in a corner and think about, I want to do this middle ground, middle road, middle ground balance concept. Objectively, it oftentimes works. I mean, you can yes, the middle ground is the best. I think relationships start to break that because, or can break it. You know, sometimes if you're a wuss, you know, you're being a wuss. I know you're being a wuss. I can objectively be like, you're a damn wuss.
Right.
But that's not the solution to that problem. I've got to go with you
to some extreme
right.
to save that relationship and that situation. Which is asking me to not be in the middle ground.
Well, I don't know if you're going to the extreme. It's called being sensitive. Right. Is that going to the extreme by being... By saying that what I wouldn't feel that way if that happened to me, we always do that. I wouldn't feel that way. First of all, you don't really know because it didn't happen to you. Okay, but let's say it did, and you were in the same exact scenario, and you didn't react the same way. I mean, is that really going to an extreme by imagining what that person felt? And it's hard to imagine what another person feels when you wouldn't have felt that. But that person is feeling that way, and you got to give that to the other person.
I feel like it's an ask. Like, if you take that situation objectively, like you said, you would react this way. But, you know, for this person, I got to be more sensitive. And it's like, does that mean sensitivity overtakes all other...
No, it doesn't mean that it overtakes values. And a lot of marital couples have this issue. Like, where do values end and emotions start and vice versa? Like, let's say your partner is... You know, is upset, but it really clashes with what you believe in, and this happens. So you have to discuss that. You have to talk about that, and
I'm not advocating like an abdication of what we believe in. You know, then
you're really losing yourself in this relationship because all you're doing is being sensitive to the other person, and you just have to let all of your values be trampled upon. No, you have to negotiate the two. But I will tell you something. I remember when I first got married, I went to one of my friends. He's a couple years younger than me, but much smarter. And he's a rabbi. And I went to talk to him about some issue. And I was, I don't know, having whatever, some issue. And then I brought up like, yeah, but isn't this the right thing? And he started laughing. He says, Mark, you want to be right or you want to be married? They're saying that now. So that doesn't necessarily mean that you just let your values go in order to stay in the relationship. But it's not about winning the debate. Because you can win the debate, you know, win the battle, lose the war. It's about trying to get into the other person's mindset. This is really hard. I remember I said this last week, easier to master 100 pages of Talmud and to change one aspect of your personality. It's hard. This doesn't happen overnight. The Rambam is telling us to go to the opposite extreme when it comes to anger. I don't think by being more sensitive and imagining the hurt the other person is feeling, I don't know. I don't think that's asking us to go to the other extreme. I think it's asking us to get out of ourselves a little.
Well, saying going to the extreme is extreme. But saying maybe don't be exactly in the middle.
Yeah, this might not be exactly in the middle.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Right.
Yeah, well, when you're negotiating. I want to finish with just one last point. It goes back to something we said before. You got to believe that in any of these things it's possible to control. If you don't believe it's possible to control, you know, it's an amazing thing. They said that nobody ever ran a minute in less than 4 minutes until Roger Bannister broke the 4 minute mile number, whatever that was. And then within weeks of Roger Bannister running a mile in a minute, in 4 minutes, all of a sudden all these other people did it. Like, I always wonder, like, what changed? Like, what changed? Simply the knowledge that something is possible. It can't enable anything. I can think that I can lift 1,000 pounds. I don't care how much I believe in myself, how long I spend at the gym, I will never bench 1,000 pounds. I'm okay with that. But I'm just saying, it's not going to happen. But when something is within the realm of possibility, and we've been convinced because, like, I'm just hardwired this way. Goes back to what Maimonides said before. That this is just not the way God made me. You know, my father-in-law, blessed memory, Jill's dad, was one of the most even-keeled people I've ever met in my life. And I don't think he worked on it so much. Like, he just, very few things. Traffic, that was the only exception. He couldn't take traffic. We went to a Yankee game once. We waited to the end of the game. I remember my older boys were little, and you never do this, by the way. Like, and he parked in the lot, and and it took us like an hour and a half to. So it was like the only time in, like, I don't know, 11, 12 years that I knew my father-in-law, blessed memory, that I ever saw him lose his cool, ever. And I don't think he worked on it. Like, he was just chill. He was just happy to be alive. He was just like a good guy, you know? So for him, but listen, he had other issues. Everybody's got their thing. None of us has everything that comes easy. We all know that. But it's an important thing to remember. One of the students of the great Chafetz Chaim related that he would occasionally see this rabbinic figure, this great rabbi of the 19th century, enter his synagogue at midnight and remain there for a certain period of time. And the student decided to follow his Rebbe, and he hid under one of the benches in the back of the shul. And at midnight, the Chafetz Chaim arrived in synagogue, opened up the ark, and he began to implore God to help him conquer his anger. Rav Nachman of Breslov, if you ever read his writings, this great Hasidic master, related that by nature he was an angry person. And he worked his entire life until he merited to get to a point where virtually nothing bothered him. And I've spoken about, during the last election, I had a favorite, but no one else seemed to agree, and that was Ben Carson, who, incredibly inspirational African-American who rose out of poverty to become one of the leading neurosurgeons. And he writes in his in a book he wrote about terrible, terrible anger issues that he had when he was a kid. And because he got over it, his life went in a very positive direction, but it could have been the end, really. And this is a very, very important thing to remember, that we have control, not over everything. We don't have control over the deck of cards. We don't have control over the circumstances, the things that just sort of happen to us. But to say that we don't have control over the way we handle them or deal with them or the personality that we have, it will for sure be more difficult for me to deal with issue A than someone else, and it might be easier for me to deal with issue B than someone else. Everybody's got their issue. But it's not an all or nothing situation. And it's just a question as to whether or not we can look inside and maybe apply some of these ideas in terms of anger. I'll end with a great line of another great Hasidic master, of Menachem Mendel of Kutsk. He once said that people are accustomed to look at the heavens and to look up and wonder what happened over there. And he always said that it would be better if we would look within ourselves and to look within to see what's going on here. Judaism doesn't want us to just look up. Judaism wants us to take some inspiration from up there and look within and see how we can tweak things here. Because that's the measure of a tzaddik, of a righteous person. And that's how we can become, as Maimonides said earlier, as great as Moses, and propel ourselves forward by battling with our inner demons and trying to do a little better and recognizing steps. It's not an all or nothing thing. It's not an all or nothing thing. All right, I don't want to keep you guys so much longer. Any other comments or questions just about anger? Yeah.
Please, please.
It's both. According to the Rambam, it's both. It's something you don't want to express behaviorally, and it's something you want to express inwardly. The latter part, the inward, you know, it sounds a little unrealistic. I grant that to you. I admit that it sounds like a little, to get to a place where we're so in control of our emotions that we don't even feel anger, but we put it on. We put on a mask of anger for our students or for our children or for other people to let other people know where we stand on a certain issue. But it's considered such an evil trait, says the Rambam, we should never even experience it ever internally. It can only wreak havoc. It can only cause something bad. I think, more superficially because of what it could lead us to do. And because it's a corrupt force within us.
It's also unpleasant to experience.
Say again?
It's also immensely unpleasant to experience.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst thing you can do. We always think it's bad for other people. The person who suffers the most is not the person who's the object of your anger. It's you. You know, we'll talk about this on subsequent. We're going to speak a little about Lashon Hara, about the way we speak about other people. So the Rambam, actually, Maimonides writes that, you know, it's not just that the person who you're speaking against is harmed because the reputation is soured, is sullied, you know, you embarrass them. It corrupts the person who's uttering the words. The same thing with anger as well. I think just being aware, you know, they say like half of therapy is just kind of like awareness, is being like aware of it. So much of Judaism is just kind of slowing life down a little, freeze framing it so you can look at it. And anger is one of those things that speeds things up. Anger is one of those things that causes us to act irrationally because we're not thinking at all. We're just operating. And I've caught myself. I don't always catch myself. It's good to have friends also who know you. I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but you know, you can turn one of your friends into your coach if you trust them and say, "Look, I've got this issue. I want you to call me out on it, not in front of other people. You know, wait till I'm done. Pull me aside and go, you're doing it again." And that's hard. That's hard because sometimes we're the worst judge of ourselves because we have these things called defense mechanisms so we can live with ourselves. You know, we need to feel good enough about ourselves. And if we keep being too down, you know, so it might be another hint, which is to talk to someone else about the issue that I'm struggling with. This is just one trait.
Simpler question, but you know, I guess when you talk about somebody, you know, drinking wine when they're drunk or angry, not being themselves, I think one other trait that sometimes lives up to kind of that level, it's not as scary as anger, but is impatience. And somebody's so impatient, they oftentimes are removed from themselves as well.
Yeah.
That it goes to this level where they're just acting based on
Yeah,
it's like impatience and anger are kind of closely related, but
First of all, this is a very relevant point today because we are very, because of the internet and technology, which is great. It's made us a more impatient generation because we used to get anything much faster, and our expectations are just much greater, and we have less patience for people. Younger people have less patience for older people, and we strip ourselves of some of the most wonderful experiences by getting to know. We had a program here last night with Jason Greenblatt, and we had Brett Stevens from the New York Times, and Marion Wiesel came. That's Elie Wiesel's wife, a great humanitarian, a Nobel Prize winner, and she's in a wheelchair. She's quite elderly, and it was just interesting. I was listening. You know, she's older, and she can't speak as quickly. She can't move as fast. She just can't operate quickly anymore, you know? And you see that when people start getting older, and some of the most important people that we should spend more time with are older. And we don't have patience for them. It's just, I see it, and I don't know what the solution is. There are studies that have demonstrated also that kids raised in the computer iPhone age, smartphone age, it's not just about iPhones, just sit for less, for shorter periods of time and don't think as long. And therefore the depth of thinking is compromised. And depth of thinking is necessary to solve certain kinds of issues. And that's a real problem. I just read another study recently. I have to find it. That talked about certain issues that require more time in order to be more thoughtful over certain problem-solving areas. I don't know what the solution is. I just being aware that we're doing this and that we need more patience. You know, it's a great point. Yeah, last question.
It's not a question. It doesn't make me a thought.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have enough empathy, it motivates you to stick around a little longer, pay a little more attention, be a little less distracted, you know, when you're trying to be attentive to another person. Yeah, staying focused on other people for longer periods of time, it's also necessary for relationship building. So some of these things are threatened today. We're living in a very strange time, in a beautiful time, but some new challenges, you know. All right, I don't want to keep you guys much longer than I should have, and I did, and I apologize. We're going to continue next week, same time, same place. You're all welcome to join. Those of you who are coming on the MJE Shabbaton this weekend, we're looking forward to having you. Bring a little something to your families, like a bottle of wine or something. Be really polite and nice. Try not to, drool when you eat at the table, and represent us nicely, and make sure to send them a thank you note when you're done. I mean this sincerely for those of you who are coming with us for Shabbat. It's a nice thing to show gratitude to your host and hostess. We'll take a 5-minute break, and Dr. Clapper, who is an amazing Torah teacher and therapist, she's a psychologist for many years here on the Upper West Side, she's going to be our guest speaker. This is open normally just for the fellows, but this is going to be open for anyone as well, if anybody wants to stick around and listen to her. She's going to be coming down, like she's here actually. So just take a break, and then you'll hear from Dr. Clapper afterwards. Have a great night, everyone. Thank you for being here. Pleasure.